Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We volunteers at KBOO are so thankful that the station is continuing to provide relevant information and wonderful music to help us maintain through this pandemic, and we're sure you share our feelings. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO has had to cancel our spring pledge drive, but you can still help us through these difficult times. Please consider becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you are already a member by going to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. The COVID-19 pandemic is a brutal reminder of how out of balance our planet has become. Decades of explosive human population growth and an increasingly mobile population have put us in close contact, squeezed natural habitats, and forced wild animals to occupy cities or perish. Today we talk with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with the Geo Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about how these factors play a significant role in causing and spreading pandemics, like the one that is now shutting down the world. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. Always a pleasure being on your informative show.
Well, before we start talking about the science of the pandemic, I just wanted to check in with you and see how you're doing during this very strange time.
Yeah, it is strange indeed. I'm doing okay. And for me personally, I actually was in quarantine the first week of March because I was exposed to someone that had COVID-19, even though I didn't. And it changed my life. It gave me time to really kind of get in touch with my surroundings, to observe how the planet is healing. And it gave me time for just some, you know, healing for myself and the Earth.
I'm curious, when you were in quarantine, that meant like you couldn't leave your house for 14 days?
Yeah, I was stuck inside. And, you know, I really valued my friends because people were delivering food and bottles of wine at my doorstep without coming in, of course. And it really made me appreciate my connections that I wasn't really that aware of because of all the travel I was doing prior to the outbreak.
Is that how you were exposed in the first place?
Yeah, I was at home in Florida with my parent and my brother got it. You know, everybody in his circle had to be in quarantine.
Interesting, because Florida seems to be one of the states that's doing the worst job of actually identifying the virus and socially isolating. And so I just was wondering what it was like for your brother to be dealing with Florida's healthcare system and all the contradictions that were coming down from the elected officials on high in Florida.
Yeah, it was a real challenge, you know, for everybody in my family in Florida, because, you know, you depend on your leaders in crises like this. And when they're putting politics and self-interest ahead of science, nobody wins in that scenario. And it really was playing out in Florida, even with their beaches. They left their beaches open during the, you know, the uptick in the pandemic at a time when, you know, everybody should have been isolating.
It's kind of interesting to think about that time in late February, early March. It was spring break. It was Mardi Gras. I think there were like 11 million people in New Orleans for Mardi Gras, some huge amount of people. I'm not sure how many millions of people were on the beaches in Florida. It's interesting because at that time, there was a lot of knowledge about COVID-19. What are your thoughts about how people just continue to gather in these huge cultural familiar rituals that people have been gathering in for these years, and they continue to do this even though there was this pandemic? What's your thought on that, particularly if you were in Florida when this was going on?
Well, you know, we're social animals. I get it. I mean, nobody likes to stay in their house for weeks. You know, I've been in my house now with some limited travel for the past 2 months. You know, we all get cabin fever. We want to be outside, especially as the weather is improving. But, you know, the virus is cheering us on. And this is how it spreads. And the closer we get, the more we think we can go back into normality without having the pandemic under control, the more the virus spreads. So it's a scary situation. And for me personally, not only witnessing the human suffering in this, but the abject denial of science and leaders like Trump that have gut feelings that we should inject ourselves with disinfectants and powerful UV rays instead of listening to his own medical experts. That's what's causing the loss of life right now, is people are listening to who they think is an informed leader and is a nutcase.
I wonder how many people actually think that Trump is an informed leader and how much of it is he's a reflection of their own fears and their own reaction. I have been getting a sense, partly from watching footage of the protests against the stay-at-home orders, and people with these signs saying, I need a haircut, I need to golf, I don't care if you die, but I need to do that. And yesterday, my wife and I were walking up this trail from Oaks Bottom in our neighborhood, and this guy, this young guy on a bicycle, came barreling down, and we started yelling at him to stop. There's a narrow trail, and he's not supposed to be on a bicycle to begin with. We finally got him to stop, and we were explaining, you need to stay away from us 6 feet. So he's kind of mocking us, and he continues to barrel down the hill going blah, 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 blah. And I got this feeling after seeing him and looking at footage of protesters that don't like to be told what to do, that there's an American trait that a lot of people have, which is don't tell me what to do. No matter who's saying it. And this seems to be a time when we really need to be listening to some people that might have a better idea. How do we do this contradiction? Because it seems like we're really seeing this big schism in basically in the whole American psyche right now.
Yeah, well, you have a president and many other leaders in government that are saying that, you know, we need to be warriors and essentially lay down our bodies for the economy so that everybody can get back to the norm. But when you think about this, if it's your grandparents or your kids that are laying down their bodies for the economy, that's not a good situation for anyone. And I choose science always over politics. We have a split in the United States right now between those that just want to follow hunches under President Trump's guidance and the leadership of several Southern representatives versus those that are actually using the data to inform people. And, you know, government's supposed to protect our lives. And fortunately, we have governors like Governor Newsom in California, Governor Cuomo in New York, and other governors that are saying, no, we're not ready to open right now because the data is telling us that we shouldn't. And our science experts are telling us that if we open up now, we're going to have untold human casualties. And as a responsible government, we don't want that, even if it means that people are going to be uncomfortable about not going out, and we've got an economic crash going on, unfortunately.
Even with some of the governors who are being credited with doing a really good job, and I'm thinking in particular of Jay Inslee in Washington State, I have some concerns that there's been a little bit of rewriting of history, particularly in Washington State. I was watching a Frontline piece about COVID-19 last night, which started out, it mostly focuses on what was going on in Washington and compared to what's going on in Washington, D.C. And it starts out with showing how they tracked down the virus from the first person who was identified with the disease back in January and just north of Seattle, and then how they were all prepared actually for the pandemic, and they were able to do all this preemptive stuff so that things wouldn't get that much worse. And then somehow it comes out, well, then they had these big clusters in the nursing home. And it seemed like the more they got into the ways that things were not going well in Washington, the more they distanced themselves from what I recalled actually happened, which was it took Washington as long to declare a state of emergency and have a stay-at-home order as it took Oregon. And I actually give Kate Brown, our governor, because you're in Oregon here too, a lot of credit for being on top of it. And now she's just announced the longest extension of the stay-at-home order of any state that I'm aware of. It's now in Oregon up to July 6th, and with no promise it'll open then. So I was a little bit concerned that both Inslee and then the mayor of Seattle were going on about how fast they shut things down and how great they did and how that's where they prevented things from getting as bad as they got in New York. And on the other hand, I recall that the big comic book conference in Seattle happened the weekend of March 7th, which was in the middle of things being really bad in Seattle, and that it took a while for things, even after they had the suggestion that you have small groups, you know, larger than 10, and that people keep 6 feet away, it wasn't really being enforced until after March 24th. I checked it after the show last night to make sure my memory was right. So I'm concerned that even the people who are doing the right thing now are rewriting their history. I have some concern about our need to be honest about the mistakes that even the, quote, good guys have made.
Yeah, I agree with you. And again, you know, the purpose of government, at least in part, is to protect human life. And I think by and large, it's a matter of risk taking. And when do you want to enter into a radical change in our lives to reduce loss of life? Do you want to do it at the onset of what could be a pandemic when you're being warned, which, you know, goes back to 2019. you know, maybe December, maybe even further back than that, when there was evidence of the possibility of a pandemic and the president covered it up? Or do you want to wait until you start working your way up that pandemic outbreak curve? And some governors chose to go higher up on the curve than others did based on risk taking and the advice they were getting from their experts. But I totally agree that in retrospect, you know, we all need to heal from this and come away with a sense of new purpose about how we avoid these things in the future.
Well, it was interesting last night on the show, on the Frontline show, there was the person who'd been, I'm not sure if he was the head of the CDC under Obama, but he was high up in the CDC. And he was basically saying that when the CDC was being so stringent about allowing individual states to produce their own tests, that that was the usual procedure. And he understood why they did it at that point, because I guess they hadn't recognized just how serious the pandemic was. And it seemed a little funny to be hearing this guy from the Obama administration, who was probably involved in the pandemic planning commission that Obama set up, to be, it sounded like almost giving the okay for what the CDC did. I guess that was the CDC think. At the same time, I didn't feel like there was enough criticism in the piece of how long it took the CDC to actually get testing going.
Yeah, I was reading about that too. And again, we're under a Trump administration, which was trying to sweep all of this under the rug. You know, early on in his press briefings, he was convinced the pandemic would go away quickly. You know, everybody could go to church on Easter Sunday. And, you know, he just totally ignored the evidence and defunded the task force that was supposed to be dealing with pandemics. And, you know, a lot of this could have been avoided if we had rapid response as soon as there was enough evidence that there was a pandemic and we knew the conditions were ripe under which you're going to get virus spread and the transfer of virus through zoonotic disease transmission, that's when we should have started clamping down.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with the Geo Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about how zoonotic diseases like COVID-19 are a classic example of where ecosystems and human health interact. And that's what we're going to get into now. I was having this thought before we zoomed into each other this morning about how I've been having this feeling for a while now that there's something emblematic about having this pandemic during the Trump administration. And there's some way in psychically in which these two things go together, these two horrors. What kind of connection do you see about Trumpism and this pandemic?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Barbara. You pointed out the divide we're in, or this unusual coincidence that we're having in the country right now. And it's coinciding with an election. And it's curious that depending on what the outcome is in terms of loss of life and whether or not the administration actually wakes up and starts listening to its medical experts and its scientists, that could decide whether Trump gets reelected.
It's also interesting that we're looking at this divide between people who are more concerned about their own, I don't even think it's their own, they're concerned about the economy, so to speak, or their desire to go golfing, get a haircut, or go bowling, versus the concern or understanding that we are in the throes of a major pandemic, that if we were to look back at history, go back just 102 years to the great influenza pandemic of 1918 and 19, that we could have millions, maybe 100 million people die as a result of this. And considering that the population now is four times what it was in 1918, it could be 400 million people dying. So that's an interesting schism to me. And I think that at the same time, there's also a schism between people who understand the need for working towards having a healthy planet again and seeing this pandemic as an example of how the planet is really out of balance, and those people who just want to keep driving their cars and doing what they've ever been doing. So let's talk about how this actually is maybe another indication of just how out of whack our entire planetary system is.
Yeah, and that was the basis of the op-eds that we ran for Earth Day on this subject. But, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and I could think of when I was an undergrad in at a university in the 1970s. And in my basic ecology class, the professor was lecturing about the incredible crisis that we were headed for because of overpopulation and the consumption of vast bulk of the world's natural resources. We were on a collision course, and that this would take place sometime in our lifetime. So that was about 40 years ago. And the issue with how we're changing the planet is it's insidious. You know, a lot of people don't realize it, except for scientists that work at a global scale and that can see the events that have been taking place over the last few decades. And we're concerned. You know, I was part of a group of scientists led by Bill Ripple out of Oregon State University that sounded an alarm to the world that if we continue to be on this course, we're headed for ultimate ecological collapse. And that was signed on to by over 20,000 scientists with all kinds of backgrounds, including those with health backgrounds, just recognizing that, you know, that fork in the road that my professor said in the 1970s is right in front of us right now. And what we do in the coming decade with our climate, with biodiversity and how we're treating the planet will dictate how many pandemics and how severe those pandemics are that are, you know, over the horizon. So this is really a wake-up call. And it's unfortunate that there's so much human suffering going on with it, but it also is a time for awareness and to change direction.
Well, one of the interesting things about this pandemic is all the stories that are coming out about wild animals returning to urban spaces, to people-occupied spaces generally, because the people aren't occupying them. And it makes me think about what those spaces were like before people occupied them. And how do you see this as maybe an indication of what is so wrong with our culture globally now, whether it's the wild animal trade or whether it's incursions into wildlife habitat? How does this pandemic reflect on that and show us maybe the source of some of the problems?
Well, this is a really interesting part of, I guess, the silver lining in all of this, if you will. And again, I'm not trying to downplay any of the suffering that everyone is experiencing from this, but the silver lining in all of it is that we've been doing this uncontrolled experiment now. As scientists, we're looking at the planet and thinking, wow, there's some major recovery going on here in a very quick time frame. It's only been a couple of months. And yet, go outside and the skies are blue. There aren't as many planes crossing the sky. We've got a reduction in global greenhouse emissions that have been happening, not nearly as enough to get the climate back into a safe trajectory. Wildlife are returning to their haunts. And, you know, the planet is just, it's recovering, just like a sick patient and like a superorganism that, you know, the Gaia theory that the Earth is just a big superorganism. It's probably taking a big, deep breath right now and saying, wow, you know, the reduced activity means that, you know, we could get these ecosystems back on the trajectory to recovery and allow people to, you know, start looking at what it means to be a sustainable world, because we are not on a sustainable path. And if we just jump right back into rapid economic growth, which is what all our leaders want, we're going to be right back on this trajectory of collapsing ecosystems and increasing pandemics, I'm afraid.
Well, there's a word I used in my little break a few moments ago, zoonotic, which is a word that you throw around a lot in your articles. And it's a word that we hear some, but not that much in the mainstream media. So I wanted to talk a little about what that word means and how that relates to this pandemic and how that relates beyond that to this trajectory that we've been on of basically interfacing too much with the wildness and not in the way of people who go wilderness hiking.
Yeah, so one of the main theories with how COVID-19 reached its pandemic state was that horseshoe bats, which occupy caves in China because of habitat destruction writ large, were forced into urban areas. And horseshoe bats have coexisted with corona-like viruses for millennia. But when you start stressing out animals, just like us, their immune system is taxed. And so as they were forced into urban areas to find habitat, they began shedding viruses. And presumably an intermediate host picked up those viruses and transferred them over to humans in clusters of outbreaks. And so here we are now, and you've got situations in China and other places that use wet markets for openly trading and consuming wildlife. We've got a history of this that is in different cultures around the world. The Ebola outbreak, for instance, was the result of deforestation in West Africa and the consumption of chimps. So that's what we are talking about pretty much with zoonotic diseases. And it's not just limited to, you know, nations on the other side of the planet. You know, when we have livestock in close containment, when we have cattle being shoved into very isolated places and chickens and pigs in isolated areas, you've got the potential for the spread of all kinds of different viruses, H1N1, all kinds of different flu epidemics have spread and transferred from animals, whether they're wild or domestic, to people. One other example in our region is Lyme disease. And Lyme disease is not at a pandemic at this point, but it has been increasing in North America as a result of a warming climate combined with an explosion in deer populations and in field mice. And guess what keeps those in check? Large predators, which have been culled around North America for quite some time. We've had a destructive relationship with wolves and other, you know, big predators that would keep those animals in check. So these ecosystems are out of balance. The planet is warming and Lyme disease is spreading. So here's another example that could reach a pandemic if we don't change course here really soon.
I want to go back to the wildland human interface, and we're not talking about the hills outside of Ashland, Oregon now, and fire danger, which is what we usually talk about with the urban wildland interface, but the one that has to do with eating bushmeat, basically. And I think that the first time that that became a serious concern, understanding the public health implications of it, was with the Ebola pandemic, and it's now being the same issue, probably, if the coronavirus came out of China. It's still some debate about exactly where even that originated. But I wanted to talk about what happens at that interface, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in Asia. In Africa, the way I imagine it, because I haven't been there, is that people hunt in the jungle and then they eat the wildlife, or I'm not sure, I'm assuming it also gets sold in cities in Africa. Maybe you can fill me in a little bit more on what that pathway is, and then we can compare that to the wet markets in China.
So a lot of it is centered on deforestation. So the first thing you've got is a road that gets built into a tropical rainforest, and then it spreads the environmental impact because it's followed by all kinds of logging and mining, displacement of Aboriginal cultures, and now you're in close contact with wild animals that are then consumed or brought in for trade. And by the way, the United States is the top country in importing wild animals in the trade market. 20% of the total wild market consumption of wild animals is here in the United States. So you've got an infected animal or, you know, disease on an animal that's then imported in the United States. Now you've got another pathway. So it's not just it's isolated in the tropics, it's not going to affect us. It gets all around the globe because we are an unprecedentedly mobile culture right now, or society. We're constantly moving around the planet. We could be on the other side of the world, you know, in a 14-hour plane flight. So it spreads because of an exploding human population in close proximity, consuming natural resources at an unprecedented rate. And we're all in contact now. So when things break out in clusters, they don't stay there.
Well, I was reading an article about, traditional Chinese wisdom and medicine and their relationship to the pangolin, the animal that's being blamed sometimes for being the pathway for the COVID-19 virus. And I guess in traditional Chinese literature, medical literature from the 16th, 17th century, they were warned not to eat the pangolin, that it would cause all kinds of distress. But now the pangolin has become this kind of fetish animal. And I understand, I guess, another article the other day about how it's the most endangered in the animal trade industry. So let's talk a little bit about the pangolin. We actually use that as the image for the show on our website. So what is it with the pangolin?
You know, I don't know much about that critter other than it's an anteater. And it's, like you said, traded a lot in the wildlife trade industry. And it's one of the theoretical intermediary hosts that may be part of that zoonotic transfer spillover pathway that scientists are now theorizing about, from bat to intermediary host to contact with people to spread in clusters to pandemic. So you can kind of connect the dots there as the one way that we think this pandemic has exploded.
Well, I want to talk also about these wet markets that have been blamed for the source of this COVID-19 virus. I'm not sure how much you're tracking about the controversy over even blaming the wet markets, but let's first of all talk about what they are, because I don't think people really understand too much what it is, what's sold there, why that those creatures are being sold, what kinds of conditions they're in before they're sold.
Yeah, you know, it's a cultural thing. So there are cultural sensitivities in any of these issues, especially when, you know, we're looking at it as outsiders, not part of that culture. You know, a lot of wild animals are openly traded and consumed in different countries, the so-called developing world. There's economics involved. You know, people are trying to feed their families, and this is one way to get money. And these animals are kept in close confinement in cages and then just kind of sold on, you know, these street markets where they're picked up by people and moved around.
Now, are they sold live or are they slaughtered before they're sold?
I think both. And sometimes they're hanging in meat racks, the photos that I've seen.
I wonder why they're called wet markets.
I don't know that, yeah.
I actually learned about this not that long ago. I was reading a lot of Carl Safina, and he was talking about the live fish markets in Hong Kong and in China, and probably, I think, in some other parts of Asia. And it was appalling. I mean, first of all, it's appalling how those fish are, quote, harvested using cyanide and other horrible things. But the whole idea of this fascination and this obsession with eating food that has just recently been killed, which I guess is becoming more and more of an issue as more and more Chinese have the disposable income to eat this way, because I guess this is the way the aristocracy used to eat. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's like everyone wants sushi. It's unfortunate it's coming from, you know, wild animals. And, you know, I'll give you an example. When I was working on my Temperate Rainforest book years ago, I was investigating the giant salamander, which is the world's largest salamander. It can grow to over 6 feet. And some of the photos that I was getting online were from wet markets where these animals were being consumed. They were, you know, hanging on meat racks. And, you know, a 6 foot long salamander was a delicacy for some people. It's a cultural thing, and there are cultural sensitivities here. So that has to be in play in any kind of solution.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with the GEO Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about how zoonotic diseases like COVID-19 are a classic example of where ecosystems and human health intersect. I'm actually thinking about years ago, and I hang out in Chinatown in Vancouver, B.C., and they had a lot of seahorses. They were all dead, and they had these jars of formaldehyde or whatever with seahorses in them, and I guess they were considered a medical treatment. And it was kind of a little heartbreaking, actually. And then understanding later about the important role that seahorses play in the ecosystems of coral reefs and how they're being decimated. But it seems like there is an old Asian tradition about using what we would consider to be rather arcane animals for food and for medicine. On the other hand, it seems like it's kind of exploded in a way that wasn't as much of an issue 50, 60 years ago.
Well, yeah, because we're approaching 8 billion people on the planet. And, you know, if we continue to grow at this rate, which is decelerating but still increasing, we're going to hit, you know, 10, 11 billion by the late century. And think of how many more people consuming how many more wild animals would be on the planet at that time and just drawing down Earth's biological systems. So I think One of the main recommendations that came out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recent report was the single most important thing to do to stabilize the climate, next to getting off of fossil fuel emissions, was to change our diets, was to get off of meat. That's a really tough cultural message to give to people, you know, because, you know, a lot of people like eating meat. And yet, this is what we're doing to the planet. We're destroying wild animals and spreading zoonotic diseases and destroying habitat and our insatiable consumption of meat products around the globe.
Then there's what's happening in this country. And it's interesting that Trump, while refusing to employ the War Powers Act to get American companies to be producing protective gear for medical workers or to be working on providing more testing for COVID-19 virus, he's enacted it to keep the meatpacking plants open. What does that say to you?
I worry about the workers. You know, there's a lot of folks that are getting ill from being in those meatpacking places, and they're getting exposed to, they have a very high rate of COVID-19 infections to begin with, and yet they're being ordered back into work so that we can supply, you know, burgers and other meat products to the fast food industry. It's just another example of having to lay down your life to keep the some segments of the economy going. And I think that's just an unfortunate way to run the country.
Well, it's also, I think, kind of endemic of something about Trump. I mean, there's these there's one photograph I've seen a lot on Stephen Colbert and on The Daily Show, where he's in some room in the White House, and it's just full of junk food, burgers and chicken, fried chicken, and I guess a bunch of chocolate cakes. And he has this grin. He's so happy. I mean, is he going to eat it all? You know, what is this picture really about? But it seemed to me, when he decided to invoke the War Powers Act to keep the meatpacking facilities open, that it was more important to him to get his burgers than it was to save lives.
Right. And, you know, at least some of those burgers are coming from the tropical rainforest, deforestation, the slash and burn agriculture that is denuding the Earth's lungs, which are our rainforest, so that we can get a cheap hamburger. And that all of it, you know, that comes into the United States is from the tropics, but the meat that is coming from the tropics is a result of deforestation. So that is why scientists are saying we need to look at the way we're consuming natural resources around the planet, because the trajectory we are on is for ecological collapse, and that's going to affect our health.
Well, while there's been a lot of focus around this in this pandemic around the consumption of wildlands meat, or bush meat, whatever you want to call it, there's another issue going on here in the United States with our meat production. Let's talk a little bit about what are some of the big problems with the way that meat is produced and distributed here in the United States, and how does that connect also with the COVID virus?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, again, the zoonotic transfer, the spillover effect is what to be mindful of. So the more you've got domestic animals cramped into tight situations and close contact between animals and humans, the greater the risk that you're going to get some transfer, spillover, or whatever those animals were carrying. So, you know, one way to avoid that is either to go to a non-meat diet or go to organic sources that, you know, are more in line with healthy eating and also healthy ecosystems. So we can make choices as consumers. We could choose a different path that is more sustainable and is better for our health in the long run.
It's interesting how this pandemic started out with run on toilet paper. And yeah. Now there's talk about a run on meat. And I was talking to people behind the meat counter at the market that I shop at, where the meat is all, it's mostly pasture raised, and it's coming from small farms and coming from basically in the Northwest. And we were talking about how as this run on meat, which is being expected, and I guess that Costco is now limiting people to only buying 5 pounds of meat or something. An irony for Costco, usually encouraging you to buy huge quantities of things. But we were talking about how people may be running over to this store now to buy meat that they would have never thought of eating before. And then there'll be a run on meat, the pasture-raised meat that they sell at the store. But I wonder, for one thing, if they switch from eating Smithson pork to eating Oregon-raised, pasture-raised pork, it might change their taste buds, and they might realize that, okay, this costs more, so I have to eat less of it because that's all I can afford. But and maybe somewhere down the line, we'll understand the ecological advantage of also eating pork that is raised in a very holistic way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the panic buying that we see during emergencies is just indicative of this overconsumption. It's like the United States is leading consumption, one of the world's leading consumption on a per capita basis. And when we get into these kind of emergencies, it's consumption on steroids. You know, people are just grabbing whatever they can off of the shelves. And it's just another example of the earth out of balance. And unless we get our consumption habits under control, and unless we bend the human population curve down, we're going to be headed for more of these. And there's ways to do family planning that are culturally acceptable to start bending that population curve down. And also there's ways to reduce our overall ecological footprint. There's a whole bunch of websites that you can put in your consumption habits and calculate your individual ecological footprint, and then look for ways to reduce that footprint, either by changing your meat consumption to a sustainable source or getting off meat entirely.
Well, the title of your article in the New Republic basically talks about the connection between public health and taking care of the planet being in balance. So why is making sure that we return the earth to a better state of balance, ecological balance, and it is in now, why is that also a public health issue?
Yeah, that's really I think the main issue here is, let's just take, for example, the loss of the projected loss of 1 million species in the coming decades ahead, because this is what the latest science has shown, because of habitat destruction and climate change. A lot of those species are beneficial to people in many different ways. If you look at plants, for instance, and medicinals, one of every four medical pharmaceuticals comes from the rainforest in the tropics. It was synthesized from tropical rainforests. If we continue to deforest the tropics, think of how many future medicines we're going to lose. And in addition, let's look at the climate. If we continue to put more greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere, within the next decade or so, we are going to see unprecedented climate change impacts, moving from significant to severe impacts on humanity. We'll see more heat-related deaths, more drought-stricken communities that are going to have a difficult time getting water supplies. We're going to see more wildfire activity in places. We're going to see, you know, more pollution in the atmosphere that affects our own health through respiratory ailments. So we're all connected in this. And the more we contaminate the planet with the byproducts of overconsumption, like greenhouse gas emissions, the more we destroy habitat, the more we take out biodiversity, the less stable the atmosphere is, which then feeds back on our own health, and as because all these systems are connected.
Well, a lot of people, maybe not a lot, but certain people have been making comments about how this pandemic is basically a dress rehearsal for the coming crisis of climate. I'm wondering how you see that.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And, you know, I part of my job is I stare at a lot of computer models that project what an increase in greenhouse gas emissions means for the climate in different scenarios, whether we start to bend down our consumption of fossil fuels or whether we continue on this accelerated path of fossil fuel consumption, will be the difference between significant and severe damages to society and the planet writ large. And so I think the path that we're on now, which is pretty much unmitigated climate-related emissions. You know, governments are trying through the Paris Climate Agreement, although Trump has withdrawn or is in the process of withdrawing the U.S. They're trying to bend down their fossil fuel emissions curves, but not being successful. So if we continue on that trajectory, we're going to see massive human dislocations of people, especially in coastal areas, will have to migrate to other places. We've already seen Native Alaskans having to relocate their villages because of the melting of the permafrost. We're already seeing island nations considering having to displace their entire populations to other areas because of sea level rise. And we're only at the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, on this, that this is the early stages of advanced climate change. If we continue in the next decade, we're moving into severe consequences based on all these different models.
Well, in the last part of the show, I'd like to go back to where we started off, talking about the way that this pandemic has kind of given a break to the rest of the planet. And I'm going back 2.5 years in my mind to the Great Eagle Creek Fire in the Columbia Gorge, which was human started. It was started by human idiocy. But it came at the end of a summer where the gorge was becoming an unbearable place to go because it was so crowded. It was being really abused by people who had no idea what you do in the woods. And as far as I was concerned, had no business being in the woods until they went to like at least a 10-week course of woods etiquette. And so as a result of that fire, most of the gorge has been closed to the public now for, we're going on the third season. And now the whole gorge is again closed because of the pandemic. So I see that, as much as I miss those trails, I see it as a great breathing space for those regions in the gorge to just kind of come back, to start healing themselves. Now we're seeing it kind of on a global way. I mean, I'm sort of seeing a comparison in a way between that fire in 2017 and this pandemic in ways that human excesses, the final result of it is it shuts human beings out of areas that we really don't know how to treat well in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I remember reading some of Carl Sagan's materials in Contact. And one of the paraphrase passages that come to mind is that, you know, humans have this incredible capacity to destroy things. And yet they have this amazing creativity to have a different outcome. And that's the choice that we face right now. And whether we're looking at a local ecosystem that's getting a break and is doing quite well without us right now, like the Eagle Creek Fire area, which actually was a beautiful fire mosaic that is going to have a lot of ecological benefits as that forest goes through different stages after the fire, or whether we're looking at what's happening at on the planet in terms of social injustice issues, in terms of gender equality or environmental destruction, how we've treated Aboriginal people. I mean, that's our history of destruction. And we have the choice now to turn this around to a more enlightened, enriched, biodiverse world that is sustainable. And a lot of that's going to be decided when the elections roll around. And whether we continue on one path versus the other could be decided by the events in November.
Well, it's interesting that it's be an election most likely between two very old white guys. To me, is more about who either one of these white guys is going to surround themselves with. So I'm wondering, how do we as citizens have input into who Joe Biden decides are going to be his advisors, his cabinet, his vice president, and how that might make a difference? Because Joe Biden by himself, I'm not real hopeful, would know what to do. But I do trust that maybe if he has the right advisors, he would listen to them. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, first of all, I have to be careful because I'm a nonprofit, so I cannot take a position on anybody's election. But I will say
I can't either, actually. But just giving, we're just going to be speaking theoretically.
Right. I think, you know, whoever the president is in the coming after the election, that person needs to choose the right advisors. They need to have scientific expertise as a right-hand person. Especially as we go through this pandemic, and maybe a special task force or maybe even a cabinet level position, as Biden has been talking about, that would be some sort of a health and climate czar that would make that connection. would be very beneficial, I think, in terms of getting to a solution on this so that we're not faced with another set of future pandemics and a collapsing world ecosystem and an unsafe climate.
I'm actually hoping rather than having a czar, maybe they have a shaman this time around.
Yeah.
Whatever works. I'm tired of those czars. Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, chief scientist for the Geo Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about how zoonotic diseases like COVID-19 are a classic example of where ecosystems and human health intersect. Well, I'm wondering, Dominic, how you see this pandemic affecting your future work. I mean, how has it impacted the work that you've done, which has mainly been around fire ecology, actually? It seems to be the focus. It seems like you've broadened a bit in the last few years, and you're certainly taking on climate issues. But how do you see your work forward during this time and then at some point when they let us out of our houses?
Well, I think what has caused me pause is how much traveling I was doing. And, you know, it was kind of a mixed blessing. On the one hand, I was doing really important work and trying to get this information out about these connections to decision makers. And on the other hand, I was contributing to my emissions footprint. And so I'm doing a lot more work now by Zoom and by other communications platforms. And I've cut down on my own personal emissions. I'm doing more, you know, work at home and not traveling a lot. My biggest disappointment, though, is I'm supposed to be in Australia right now on an 8-week fellowship position studying how that region has responded from their fires that took place in their fire season. And that was an interesting project that is on hold right now because the Australian people faced a double whammy. First, they had this unprecedented increase in their bushfires, and now, you know, they're in lockdown mode, just like the rest of us, because of the pandemic. So the double whammy there, and we may see the same thing here in our region because we're in an unprecedented drought, which is at least attributed in part to climate change. And so we're going to have a very active fire season here, and coming out from a pandemic and going into smoke is just not a good situation to be in.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because that's a big concern. I mean, I've been following that too, and it makes me nervous. I've been really happy it rained so much last week, and it's supposed to rain all next week. I'm not sure what it's going to do down your way, where you're in a more severe drought. But what are we going to do? I mean, we're probably still going to be in lockdown, or we should still be in lockdown for most of the summer. What happens when the fires start, especially when people have to leave their homes?
Well, I think we need to be especially vigilant that we are not causing the fires. And about 50% of the fires in our region are human caused, accidental, arson related, firecrackers, which was the Eagle Creek fire. That has to stop. And that means seasonal closure of roads so that we're not in there even, you know, accidentally starting a fire because a campfire broke out or sparks from someone's car. So, you know, that's one way to cut down on unnatural fires. The other way is we've got to stop logging the forest the way we have been, because one thing we do know is that fires misbehave when they encounter extreme fire weather, which are droughts, high winds, unnatural conditions caused by forests that have been turned into flammable plantations. And I think there's an opportunity here for Governor Kate Brown to make that connection as she looks at emergency sectors and emergency response from the pandemic, that they really need to back off of logging in the state of Oregon the way they have been, because it's going to contribute to these uncharacteristic fires that are putting more particulates into the atmosphere, and it's going to make everyone's breathing a lot worse, especially COVID-19 patients.
Well, while you're at your house spending a lot of time in front of your computer screen and Zooming, what ways do you think that you can have an impact on Governor Brown and her advisors? And also, I mean, the state legislature, and you've got a really great state senator, Jeff Golden. I mean, you've got some good representation down there. So how do you see that you might be able to make a change this fire season?
Well, you know, fortunately, we are working in a coalition of groups right now that include environmental groups, working with Physicians for Social Responsibility, with 350.org groups, because we see the connection here. And this is a very diverse coalition that's come together and has been asking the governor to show some restraint when it comes to logging forest in Oregon at a time when we need to be cleaning up our air quality and not putting out more emissions and not starting more fires from logging equipment and not converting our forest into flammable tinder boxes by taking out old growth trees and mature forest and replacing them with flammable tree plantations. So that connection needs to be made, and a diverse coalition has come together to notify the legislature and the governor that when they do their emergency response, they don't include increases in logging, they don't roll back environmental protections that relate to air quality and protecting our natural resources.
Well, we've seen some very encouraging changes on the state level with Kate Brown and the agencies, particularly the way that they are denying permits for the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline, and not only denying the permits, but making a firm stand that they will stand up to the federal government and fight tooth and nail to uphold Oregon law. On the other hand, I know that the feds in the Mount Hood National Forest, that there's been a lot of logging going on, small sales, but still logging going on the east side of Mount Hood. And meanwhile, watchdog groups like BARC can't go out in the woods and do any ground truthing. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah, that's a real concern. And the environmental community has been paying particular attention to that, asking the administration not to expedite logging. And this is, you know, another example of rolling back environmental protections, rolling back air quality protections, you know, pretty much weakening the Environmental Protection Agency at a time when we need to be improving air quality, not reducing air quality. And it pertains to our forestry sector as well. And, you know, forestry emissions are one of the top sources of global warming pollution in the state of Oregon. And if we're going to have a clean atmosphere and healthy air quality, we need to identify all sources of emissions, not just coming from fossil fuel use, but from how we're logging our forest, because every time we cut down an older forest, most of that carbon winds up going up into the atmosphere. Some of it's stored in wood products. Some of it comes back from replanting trees. But the vast majority of it winds up polluting the atmosphere with more emissions at a time when we need to be drastically cutting our emissions from all sources and storing more carbon in forests by allowing them to mature to old age as they sequester carbon over centuries.
So in the coming days, as you're still sequestered at home for the most part, though I do imagine you going out for some nice walks, I hope, since we can do that in Oregon.
Oh yeah, I've been doing a lot of gardening and riding my bicycle.
What are actually you hoping to accomplish, let's say, in the next few weeks during this continued sequester?
You know, I think it comes back to why I led the effort to write the op-ed that was in the New Republic and several of the regional newspapers. It was to really sound the alarm and to start working with healthcare professionals, with physicians, with scientists that work on climate change to come together to provide the information so that decision makers can make informed decisions about our health and safety. And while the emphasis right now, rightfully so, has been on how do we keep our population safe from the COVID-19 pandemic, as we look ahead and as we come out of this pandemic, we can start forming these diverse coalitions to start tackling these bigger problems that show the connection between planetary and human health. There's an incredible opportunity here to go on a different path forward and learn a lesson here as a society, as a species, that we can have a different future, a healthier planet, and something that we could pass on to future generations. That's the opportunity that lies ahead for us.
Well, I hope he really sees that opportunity, and I'm really glad you're doing the work you're doing. So thanks so much for doing what you're doing, and thanks for being on Locus Focus today.
Thanks, Barbara. Stay healthy.
You too. Today we've been talking with Dominic De La Salle, chief scientist with the GEO Institute in Ashland, Oregon, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping us all volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. Because the COVID-19 pandemic has forced us to cancel our spring pledge drive, which would be going on right now, we are asking you, our listeners, to help us if you can by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. We understand that these times are hard for all of us and that many of you are in no position to give away any money right now. But if you can, we really appreciate it. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll celebrate the 40th anniversary of Mount St. Helens eruption as we go on a virtual tour of the mountain led by Charlie Christofulli, who's with the Pacific Northwest Research Station. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
From way up high, abstracted natural bio-relief witness from the sky, clouds that cast a single shadow, drifting, moving on the ground, creating an illusion as the world goes round. Have a geometric grace, circle, square, sometimes triangle, ruled with lines in space, waterways and craggy mountains seemingly reveal a plan, just as if somebody drew it with a great big giant.